Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Oh, then came the day when God called him home. He went up to heaven, but he didn't go alone. Took his saddles, took his tools. Now he's up in glory land, and he's training them mules with a 2x4, 2x4, while he trains mules with a 2x4, 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 while he trains mules with a 2x4.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Kevin Kirby? Y'all like Kevin? The lead singer of local favorite Mulehead, singer-songwriter Kevin Kirby grew up in Texas and now makes Little Rock his home. He has CDs for sale after the show, and you can find out more and get the weekly joke at kevinkirbylovesyou.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark toured extensively with the late blues legend John Weston and can be heard on his CDs, Blues at Daybreak and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and our feature artist tonight is Delta artist V.L. Cox, and our featured piece is this one right over here, entitled The Sugar Thief, from her Images of the American South collection. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and V.L. at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our stories are all about a watershed moment in the writer's life. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Justin Booth's crisis point comes way too soon, and we'll end the night with Paul Prater, his uncle, and an unwanted milestone. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Nolan Dean and a watershed moment in more ways than one in The Day I Became an Artist.
My parents always believed my last words would be, "Hey, watch this." I'm not sure how that started or when the neighbors first placed bets on how I would die, but I do know that the moment I donned a pair of Superman pajamas, I've lived for adventure. So it came as no surprise to my parents when I called them one Saturday afternoon to tell them about my latest, most life-changing adventure of all. After an all-night drive, our Suburban full of college students pulled into our destination, the Gulf of Mexico, Matagorda Bay to be exact, the closest major body of water to Austin, Texas. Colin, who I like to think of as like surfer Jesus, jumped out of the car shouting, "We're at the freaking ocean!" At 5 a.m., we frolicked in pitch black waves, drinking in the joy of life like kids in a Jack Kerouac book. The only visible thing on the horizon was a blinking red light. Colin explained that this little light was why we drove all night long. He wanted to touch it. It made no sense, but I was on an adventure, and it was a chance to do something dangerous. Sensible or not, I was going to do what I came here to do. So, through a gray horizon, we watched an angry morning tide crash onto the jetty. The jetty itself stuck out of the water like a sharp black spine, about the length of a football field. Though dreary, it held its own beauty, and I just wanted to get caught in the crossfire. I wanted to feel the force of the sea, take what it would throw, and stand up after it all. So when Amber asked, "Should we really do this?" I simply hopped on the rocks and began walking toward the little red light. I might as well have said, "Hey, Watch this. I crouched low and skipped across the rocks. Their surfaces were slick, and I had to be sure of every step. Each time a wave came, I'd lie flat, hug the rocks as the waves washed over my slender body, hop up, and move just a little bit closer to my little red light. One wave lifted me off the ground and dropped my leg hard on the rocks, cutting my thigh. Another tore my hands off the crag, but just before I tumbled into the sea, I reached out and caught a tree limb that was wedged in a crack. I had asked the ocean for an adventure, and it delivered. In the end, I reached my destination, a dirty pole with a blinking red light for a crown. I turned back to my friends and saw they were in the water swimming back for the beach. I decided to join them, thinking this adventure was over. The beach was 75 yards away, and I've heard stories of Navy SEALs who can swim for miles and old people staying adrift for days at a time, so I'm thinking, yeah, I'm just going to swim to that beach. Piece of cake. So I climbed down to the sea and hopped in, completely sleep-deprived and hungry. I had chosen not to eat that day since I had just seen a powerful documentary about starving child soldier refugees, and I wanted to experience some sort of solidarity with them. Perhaps most importantly, I never heard of, much less experienced, a riptide. After 25 yards, something changed. The ocean started to pull me backwards. I pulled and kicked, but with every stroke, the undertow matched my effort and ripped me back to where I started. The adrenaline rush from the jetty had fallen to a low, and now I was getting tired. My feet kicked with increasing intensity just to tread water. I needed to shed weight, and by this moment, I'd already ditched my favorite pair of shoes, so I looked down at my favorite jacket with regret. People have died in these situations because of dumb reasons like this. I thought to myself, you know, images of the Titanic filling my mind, I've got to get rid of this thing. I reached for the zipper and began to pull down, but it didn't move. It stuck. I began treading water furiously, forcing the thing open, and it's still not moving. I begin to lose more and more precious energy in my frustration. Calm down, Nolan, I told myself. Don't freak out, don't panic. In movies, the people who panic always die first. So I looked up and I saw Colin in the distance walking towards the car. Help, I yelled. It took a dual effort by my legs to keep me up as I shouted it. He didn't respond. I grabbed my favorite jacket with both hands and wrenched it free, tossing it behind me. I turned back to Colin to see him still walking away. I was exhausted and alone. In that moment, for the first time in my life, I thought I might die. Appropriate for a writer, I looked at my situation through the lens of self-reflection. Ah, so this is what it means to fear death. My whole life up until this moment, I wanted to feel danger because I never truly felt it. I taunted death because I never learned to fear it. I was nothing but an ordinary, upper-middle-class white kid who had never known need. In that moment, I thought about the child refugees in the documentary I watched that week. They felt the same deep, consuming fear for their lives every day of their life. And not only that, but they worried for the lives of everyone they knew every day of their lives. As I thought about this, I began to understand, for the first time in my life, what the basic human need for survival is. We need to survive. It's a human right. Up until this moment, I'd always been a banal film student, with nothing to say, who watched movies with nothing to say. All my films were about cold, cynical hitmen. I had never really known empathy. I wouldn't say my life flashed before my eyes in that moment, but I did reflect on what had been going on in my life lately, and all I could come up with was, I'm just now realizing this. I need to survive. I need to make it through this. So I kicked up with both legs, and with as much power as I could, I screamed, "Help!" Humility washing over me in one extended exhale. I pulled myself back above water level just in time to hear a faint, "What?" in the distance. Colin started to walk towards me. Again, I shouted, "Help!" I tried to swim, but the exhaustion was taking over, and I struggled to stay above water. "Is something biting you?" he yelled back. I was not aware that Matagorda Bay was notorious for shark attacks. which was a good thing because I had that cut on my leg. No, I said, I've run out of energy. Thankfully, Surfer Jesus had spent more time around the ocean than I had, and he understood the way a riptide works. Lay on your back, he yelled, running out to the edge of the sandbar. You can do it, Nolan. This is how far you have to get. You can do it. Colin says that he watched me save myself, but I know better. My muscles may have pulled me in, but his voice gave me the strength to push through my fatigue. Truly, we are not meant to go through this life alone. At the end of a long, grueling struggle, I kicked a final time. Colin reached out, took hold of my wrist, and pulled me onto the sand. The earth had never felt so sweet. At first, I had to put my full weight on him, and we almost fell in face first. But with his help, I found my balance and started walking back. And then after a few steps, the unparalleled joy of survival sunk in. A new rush of adrenaline flooded my bloodstream, and with a joy I haven't felt since, I ran, jumped, screamed, and hollered, "Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh! That just happened!" It was only years later that I realized, as I stumbled through that sandbar in ecstasy, the sea level dropping from my waist to my ankles, I was, in fact, taking my first toddling steps out of banality and into empathy, and in the process, becoming a true artist. 1 year later, to the day, I would fast again, this time to prepare for my first feature film, a documentary about three courageous men who were murdered for their faith just days after my test against rock and sea. Looking back, I find that timing to be pretty ironic. The day I became an artist, I'd already begun to starve.
Nolan Dean is a Texas filmmaker currently living abroad in Arkansas. He is in the process of developing his second feature film, a romantic comedy for men titled Last Shot Love. More can be found at nolandeanfilms.com. Next on Tales from the South, Justin Booth's loss sets the rest in motion in Supreme.
Cletus had called earlier and told us he was getting a new car, something he had spotted in the paper and badgered his mother into buying for him. He'd always been able to get his way with her, but now that he was dying, she didn't have a chance. On the way to Walmart with my wife, Melanie, and our three kids, I stopped by to give it a look. We parked in the street out in front of his place, and Cletus was out the screen door before we could even get out of the car. "She's a good-looking ride," I said. "What is it?" my wife asked. She already knew, but afforded him the opportunity to say. She stood in as a woman he could brag to, a feminine ear, to listen to his woes. But by those days, he had only the ghost of a woman, and her memory haunted his mind. He flirted shamelessly with my wife in front of me. We all knew that it was totally harmless, and that he would be dead soon. "That there is a 19 and a 77 old Cutlass Supreme," he said, "just like the one I had back just after high school." He carried a plastic tumbler filled with coffee in his good hand. The other, the one curled eternal by a teenage accident, held a Marlboro 100, ashes 2 inches long, but holding on as if by some stubborn mojo learned from Cleet himself. I could count, if I tried, the number of times I had seen him without these two things, caffeine in one hand and nicotine in the other. He'd given up booze and methamphetamine before I met him, and these took their place. The car was a sort of cross between silver and gray, the color of impending storms. It looked as if it might lurch forward of its own volition. The lines of it reminded me of some great African cat that was able to project great speed and power while completely still. "She's got a 350 Rocket V8 and a 3-speed hydromatic transmission." He looked over at me and added, "You know, they actually made these with a stick." He wore a rare smile. He had been heartbroken a decade since his wife left him. maybe even a little longer. She was still his favorite topic of conversation unless some grand event like the purchase of this car took place and took his mind from her for just a moment. I was as close to him as anyone in the world. I was a bricklayer then, and on days that rain made the work I did impossible, I would ride with him to some spot or other across the state for dialysis. His temper had gotten the best of him in our hometown of Jonesboro, and he was no longer allowed treatment at the local hospital. He had also been removed from the list. He would get no kidney unless someone he knew ponied one up. I had already started the tedious process of finding out if mine were suitable. Initial tests looked promising. If things continued to go well, and I prayed they would, I would have to quit shooting smack. "Look at those headlights," he said. They were square, and there were four of them, giving them a much more menacing appearance than its round-eyed, cutlass cousins. He droned on and on about the Supreme, but the truth was, I wasn't really much of a car guy, and I wasn't listening. I was worried about him. I saw a man whose life, under the best of conditions, would be much too short. Hardly fair, since he was one of the best people I'd ever hung out with in my life. My wife kept circling the car with him. He kept pointing out details. Leather seats, yada yada this, yada yada that. We kept nodding and smiling, but the kids were still buckled into car seats and getting restless. Cletus just barely had time to point out the ball hitch someone had added before I let him know that we had to go. He had no boat, but loved to spend his troubled weekend nights catfishing. After all, he already had the ball hitch. I knew the purchase of some small craft would not be far behind. Cletus hugged Melanie, and we got into the car and drove off. In those days, I laid brick every day I could, but with a growing family and work subject to the whims of nature, I had a plan B. In spring, I enjoyed a rain day as much as anybody, riding shotgun in the Supreme and smoking weed with Cletus, happy to listen to stories of better days when good health and a woman had still been his. Winters, though, the weather would sometimes be too cold for the mortar to set properly before it would freeze. There were times when the temperature would shut down our whole crew for a week or more. Those weeks and bills to pay, I caught work with my pot dealer, Robbie. He was a painter, and while I didn't make the wages I normally earned laying brick, at least nobody would starve. Since he was a block away and had more pot than I did, I would ride to the work with him every day in his truck. We were coming into Jonesboro from Bono, coming up on Culberhouse Street where Cletus lived. I had just snuffed out a joint when I saw the lights, and my heart fell through my gut. One ambulance was parked in the street in front of Cletus's house. Another in the yard. "Wonder what all that is," Robbie said in a weed-induced stupor. "It's my friend Cletus. Let me out." The MTs had just slammed the door on the van. "What happened? Where is he?" "We're going to St. Bernard's," the medic said. It was a moment or so before I came back to myself, because by the time I looked around, the ambulances were both gone. I stood alone in the yard next to the 77 that Cletus was so proud of, the car that he had browbeat his mother into buying for him less than a year before, shamelessly guilting her with the fact that his life was short, that she would bury him soon. I looked through the window and saw his car keys. He never took the keys from the ignition. Everyone in this old part of town knew him, and I guess it just didn't seem like a real big deal to him, all things considered. I jumped in and fired it up, dropped it into gear, and peeled out, headed for the hospital, the same one that had denied him treatment, the very same hospital that had ruined his arm and his hand as a young man when his life was still all before him. His mother and his sisters were there. I didn't need to hear anything. When I turned to take off, his 70-year-old mother caught me before I could get back to the car. She talked to me gentle and low, offering me comfort. I was ashamed that it was not me consoling her, but could do nothing about it. She wiped at my tears, then went to her purse and handed me money to get high. We were family, after all, and she knew me. I didn't go home that night. I still don't know who called my wife. There was no way I could have told her. At the funeral, I was so loaded that I stumbled carrying the casket. We got through it. After me and the other pallbearers helped the guys pick up the folding chairs at the cemetery, Cletus's mom talked to me a moment, then pressed his car keys into my hand. "He would have wanted you to have it," she said. I drove it for a while. My kids called it the Batmobile. They loved how I could coax the big, heavy car into a little sideways as we would turn the last gravel corner on our way home. It always made me a little sad, though. Finally, when another close friend of Cletus's had a son who was turning 16, I gave it to that boy. I was never really a car guy, and Cletus would have been prouder to have this budding young gearhead with it than me. I was sure of that. I saw it sometimes sitting on the side of Nettleton Avenue when I would go into town, the car always freshed and washed and shining. Oh, Cletus would have loved that, I think. His 77 Supreme sitting on the strip for all the other car guys to admire. And somehow that gave me peace.
Previously homeless for 5 years, Justin Booth is a U.S. Army vet who has worked as a bricklayer, ridden in a motorcycle gang, and served time in prison. His work has appeared in magazines and anthologies both in the U.S. and abroad, and his critically acclaimed book of poetry, Trailer Park Troubadour, was released in 2013. In our final story of the night, here at Tales from the South, Paul Prater realizes there's no going back in The End of Summer.
I must have been about 8 when I watched my Uncle Avery stomp a copperhead to death with his boot heel. He pulled out a pocket knife and cut the belly of the snake open. Baby copperheads raced everywhere, and he danced one of the finest jigs I've ever seen as he stomped on all those snakes. Uncle Avery was a bit of an anomaly for Greasy Creek, Kentucky. This is where we spent our summer vacation every year. Back then, everyone in Arkansas knew that if your parents had a little money, you went camping. Maybe you got to go to Magic Springs. If your family had a little more money, you got to go to Branson or Dallas, which meant Silver Dollar City or Six Flags. If your parents had a lot of money, or if you had kind grandparents, or you were just plain lucky, you got to go to Florida, or maybe even the holy grail of all summer vacations, Disney World. But not my family. We got to go to Greasy Creek, Kentucky, where my dad's family's from. But I felt like the luckiest kid on the planet. Greasy Creek was like something out of a movie. This would have been a location scout's dream for the ideal hillbilly locale. This is a land where moonshine flowed freely. There were no questions about your religion or which church you went to, because there was only one, the old regular Baptist church. Everyone lived up the holler. People would ask which family you were from. There were only about 4 families left, and they were curious as to how you were related to them, because undoubtedly you were in some manner. While Greasy Creek may not have been the ideal locale for a young boy's summer vacation, there was some fun to be had. I liked to stay at my Uncle Avery and Aunt Ole's house. Now, Ole's name was spelled O-L-A, but I never once heard a single person call her Ola. It was pronounced Ole. And then there was Uncle Avery. One of the reasons he was an anomaly for the area was that he left, but still came back. Most people who managed to escape Greasy Creek didn't make a return. However, he signed up for the military, did his tour of duty in World War II, and did come back. He built a fine house, planted fruit trees, and dug a well that provided clean, cold water. His home may have been the nicest in Greasy Creek. He vowed to never leave again. He saw more of the world than he wanted to in a way that might spoil a lot of people from wanting to see much more. My relatives now tell me that I look like him. He was also one of the handsomest men I've ever seen. He also had a tattoo. Now, in this day and age, when every other person has a tattoo, it might not sound too unusual, but there weren't any tattoo parlors in Greasy Creek, so anyone with a tattoo had obviously left. I remember being a very young child and sitting on his lap, running my fingers over the watery blue lines of the faded tattoo. It was a naked woman in a martini glass with the words "man's ruin" written underneath. Now, at the time, I certainly didn't get it. Now, I wouldn't mind having that tattoo. And finally, he didn't have children. In an area where there were no theaters, no shopping, no TV, children were the natural outcome of one of the only sources of entertainment. To be childless was quite unusual. Because of that, or perhaps in spite of it, Uncle Avery was very tolerant of me following him around, and follow him around I did. He seemed to me to be one of the biggest, toughest, and strongest men I'd ever met. One time I sat on a stool as he shoed a horse, who somehow managed to hammer one of the horseshoe nails through his thumb. He simply pulled the nail out with a claw hammer, poured some moonshine on it, and went back to shoeing. That was tough. The moonshine bottle was half empty, so that might have had something to do with it. Until I was about 8 or so, I didn't know what a real piggyback ride was. He'd place me on the back of a muddy sow and tell me to hold on. This was the children's version of bull riding. A pig will run and buck and do everything in its power to get that little human off his back. This would always end with me in a pile of what I always hoped was just mud, in a pigsty with my uncle letting out his big booming laugh. Now, Uncle Avery and I had a game we would play. He had an old Walking Liberty silver dollar. It was a coin I wanted. He told me that if I could grab it, it was mine. He'd place the coin in his palm, inviting me to grab it, then snap his hand closed before I could do so. We played this game every summer. Again, he didn't have children, so he didn't understand the concept of letting a child win. The one good thing about this game is it gave me something to look forward to every summer. As I got older, I realized I was probably getting a year closer to be able to move fast enough to make that coin mine. It was finally the summer between 6th and 7th grade. This was my summer. The silver dollar was gonna be mine. I was bigger and I was faster. After making the long road trip to Kentucky, the first thing I did was took the hike up the holler to my Uncle Avery's house. Nothing could have prepared me for what I saw. I walked in, and he was lying in a bed in his living room. He couldn't speak or eat and barely could move. He had Lou Gehrig's disease, also known as ALS. He didn't want anyone to know how bad he was. He didn't want anyone to worry. We communicated by writing on the little children's magic slates. I couldn't stay long. I didn't want to see that strength and power sapped, taken from this person, lying immobile in front of me. That was the last summer I saw Uncle Avery. He died a few months later. My Aunt Ole sent me the coin along with a letter. Only then did I find out it had been his good luck charm in World War II. He kept it in his pocket his entire life. Mountain people are often very superstitious, and she felt that the luck had run out. I still have that coin. Every once in a while, I pull it out of my pocket, look at it, and think of my uncle. I think about that game we played, his large calloused hands, too fast for a boy's to catch. And I realize that finally getting that coin was a turning point, that last summer when childhood ended.
Paul Prater is a published author, regular performer of sideshow and mind-reading stage shows, an attorney, and a father. He is a resident of North Little Rock. To learn about him, go to paulprater.com. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argento Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argento Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
My name's Kevin Kirby. I'm from Hillcrest. If I hold my mouth just right, I might speak in tongues tonight. If I put the right words on top of just the right chords, I might be who I thought I was. If you believed half of what I said, a quarter of the things I said I did, I'd be 80 years old with a voice made out of gold if I was who I thought I was. All jokes and jabs aside, every sin is based on pride. And all the lies you told, like a bag that's come unstole, will spill out somewhere along the ride. But thank the Lord above, someone called my bluff and by the collar took me firmly off the hook, and I'm not who I thought I was. I'm not who I thought I was. I'm not who I thought I was.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.